I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. For the last 2 weeks, the focus in this country has been on the RNC and the DNC. Right before the conventions, there was a failed coup in Turkey that could have toppled the government of President Erdogan. An estimated 300 people were killed until Erdogan took back control, and now 60,000 people in the military, the judiciary, the media, the government, even in education, have either been detained, forced to resign, or are under investigation. That has exacerbated tensions between Turkey and the West, including the United States. And just to add to the complications, President Erdogan has blamed a cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, for orchestrating the coup, something Gulen has denied. And furthermore, Turkey is a staging ground for the fight against ISIS and has taken in several million refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria. We begin our conversation with Tim Arango. He's Baghdad and Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. In fact, we're reaching him in Istanbul by Skype. He has been covering the failed Turkish coup. And Tim Arango, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we're happy to have you with us. What is the mood in Istanbul today?
Well, you know, things have calmed down a little bit. If you go out on the streets, it feels normal. But obviously, these are not normal times. And of course, everybody is kind of walking around wondering what has happened to the country, foreigners alike, with Turks who have, you know, spent recent years seeing themselves as this, you know, growing power, a wonderful place for tourism, and now it's mired in so much chaos.
Is Erdogan, has he maintained, or what is his popularity today, or is it too soon to tell after the failed coup?
You know, Erdogan has always been a very, very popular leader among his constituency, which is roughly half of the country and is mainly the, you know, the religious conservative part of the country. And he's certainly become even more popular with his people. They came out on the streets the night of the coup and, you know, flooded public squares and confronted the army. And Erdogan has made them feel like they saved the country from this you know, this violent coup.
And how much do we know about the coup and how organized or perhaps even how disorganized it was?
Well, it was apparently very organized. They were able to mobilize many units of the military to shut off bridges in Istanbul, to fly fighter jets. They bombed parliament. It very well could have succeeded. But the word is that they started actually earlier than they thought they or that they had planned. And so it was a hasty beginning because they felt that Turkish intelligence had gotten wind of it. But if they had been able to do it, say, at 3 a.m. when everybody was asleep, it very well may have succeeded.
And this was led by what kind of factions within the military?
Well, of course, Erdogan has accused followers of Fethullah Gulen, the cleric in Pennsylvania, of staging the coup. And, you know, there's a consensus here that that is exactly what happened, that these are followers that had infiltrated and taken up positions in the military over the years, had become disenchanted with his rule and sought to topple him. Meanwhile, others say that perhaps there were also secular officers who had felt disenfranchised under Erdogan who had taken part. But even, you know, American diplomats even privately will say that they believe that not necessarily that Fethullah Gulen himself was involved, but that certainly those that are loyal to him perhaps took part.
Did some of the people taking part, did they know that they were part of a coup?
No, not all of them. You know, it relied a lot on conscripts of the army, particularly, for example, shutting down the bridges in Istanbul. And it became clear after that they, you know, were following orders and thought that they were perhaps doing an exercise.
This is not the first time there has been or an attempted military coup in Turkey. Help us understand that.
There's a long tradition of the military intervening to topple elected governments. In 1960, there was the first coup. 1971, 1980. In 1997, there was a military intervention with a memorandum to topple the first Islamist prime minister. So there's always been this tradition of the army seeing itself as the guardian of Turkey's secular foundations, its secular principles, and that they would step in at times when they felt those were threatened.
You described that being, and they have a large military, about 500,000 soldiers, that the military is a symbol of Turkish identification. What do you mean by that, Tim?
Well, the army has always been a venerated institution here, and there's still conscription. So it's this unifying sort of force for, you know, for young men who have to join the army, regardless of if you're religious, if you're secular, if you're this or that, everybody, it's a common experience and it's a socializing force. And for people in lower social classes, it's been seen as a place for social mobility. You can move up the chain of social classes.
There's something like, 60,000 people that have either been detained or forced to quit their jobs or maybe even arrested. Who are these people?
So there's certainly been thousands of military officers and other soldiers who have been either arrested or dismissed for allegedly directly taking part in the coup. There's also been tens of thousands of others from the state bureaucracy and other professions, such as teachers, who have been dismissed from their jobs for allegedly being followers of Fethullah Gulen. And what we've seen is that Erdogan has used this to purge the state and other professions of this group.
If you've got teachers who are no longer teaching, what's going to happen when the schools open?
That's a very good question, and we're waiting to see. They're trying to hire other teachers who can take these positions. But that's a very good question, and we're waiting to see. And also, perhaps there will be a process where people can challenge their dismissal, so we may see some coming back after a period of investigation. But it's not a very transparent process, and so those are questions that we do not know the answers to yet.
I mean, is this a sort of a loyalty oath to the president?
It certainly can be seen that way. The interesting thing is the traditional opponents of Mr. Erdogan, secular Turks and Kurds and nationalists, they've also always been suspicious of the Gulen movement. So while they're nervously watching this and wondering if Mr. Erdogan will end up going after all people he considers his enemies, they're largely standing by and in some ways supporting this purge.
Are there any reports of either mistreatment or even abuse of people who have been arrested and detained?
Yes, absolutely. Amnesty International put out a report alleging torture of some of the military personnel who were arrested. And there's been pictures on social media that show them to be bruised and battered. So there's certainly those allegations out there, which the Turkish government has denied.
Now, the head of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was in Turkey yesterday talking with Turkish officials. You reported on this. What did they talk about?
They certainly talked about the fight against ISIS. I think from a U.S. perspective, that was a worry as soon as the coup happened. What would this mean for the Turkish-U.S. Cooperation against ISIS? And the other big issue right now between the United States and Turkey is the fact that Fethullah Gulen lives in Pennsylvania and Turkey is trying to have him extradited. And so that was discussed yesterday as well.
And what do you think it's hard to know. And what has been the response to at least talk of extradition, the response in Turkey?
Well, Turks don't understand why America, the United States, has not just turned him over. There's widespread consensus in Turkish society that this guy was behind the coup, and they don't understand why Mr. Gulen, who is a Turkish citizen, is not simply handed over. But the United States has a process for this, a legal process, and Turkey needs to provide credible evidence that could stand up in a court during an extradition process. And there's a lot of doubts among American officials that they will be able to provide that sort of evidence.
President Obama supported the president of Turkey after this failed coup. Does that tell us where the U.S. stands with this coup and its aftermath?
Well, certainly the United States is opposed to toppling, democratic governments, especially a NATO ally. So that was no surprise. However, there is a widespread view or suspicion of the United States within Turkey, particularly because Mr. Gulen lives in the United States. Turkey is a place where conspiracy theories run rampant, and many, many Turks are suspicious and believe that the U.S. somehow supported Gulen or was somehow involved in the coup.
Let me read an email we got from Joan. She said, at a professional conference, Turkish friends who teach at state universities were clearly very anxious about the situation in Turkey, expressed their dislike of Erdogan and fears for Turkey's future. They said he was elected by an uneducated populace and propped up by a couple of Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia. Can you speak to that?
Well, certainly there is a lot of fear among academics. Academics have been targeted well before the coup. And so there is that fear, particularly about voicing your opinion. Turkey is not a friendly place for freedom of the press or freedom of expression. I would say, though, that what the writer reflected is a common sentiment among sort of the educated elite that the people who are Mr. Erdogan's constituency, which are tend to be rural, pious people who were basically second-class citizens before Erdogan came to power and sort of empowered them. And so there is a lot of elitism among educated Turks or secular Turks who once saw themselves as the rulers of the country. There's a lot of elitism towards the people that support Mr. Erdogan. But it has to be said that Mr. Erdogan was elected many, many times in free and fair elections, and that's democracy.
How many refugees are there in Turkey, and are they largely from Syria?
I think there's roughly 2 to 3 million, and they're mostly Syrians. There's a lot of Iraqis, too. I cover Iraq, and I've known a lot of Iraqis who have come to Turkey, but it's in the 2 to 3 million range.
Hoping, what, to make it to Germany or some of these other countries in Europe?
Well, either that, but the door kind of closed on that earlier this year when Turkey and the European Union reached a deal to stop or to try to contain the flow of migrants. So, you know, there's many, many hundreds of thousands of Syrians that have been here for years and are trying to make a life of it here. And they love, I have to say, they love Mr. Erdogan because he's, you know, Turkey's reached out to them when this war started, and they're starting to do things to allow them to work legally. And Mr. Erdogan has even talked about offering citizenship to Syrians.
And what about the Kurds? What role or how do they fit into this picture?
Well, the Kurds, of course, there's been a Kurdish militant group called the PKK, which for, you know, 30 some odd years has been fighting in the southeast. It's ebbed and flowed over the years. And over the last year, that war has picked up again in the southeast, and that war is kind of raging there. So they're very much, you know, they have their own challenges and fights here within Turkey. It should be said that one of the generals, one of the officers who was purged and arrested and charged with being part of this coup, was leading military operations in the southeast. The Kurds, though, have no love for the Gulenists. They, you know, the Gulenists, everyone believes, had opposed earlier efforts by Mr. Erdogan to make peace with the Kurds and to offer more rights to the Kurds. So they, you know, I think they're watching this right now very warily, but I don't think they have any objections to trying to root out suspected Gulenists from the state.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for getting our conversation started today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. A pleasure for us as well. Tim Arango joining us from Istanbul by Skype, and he is Baghdad and Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. We are focusing on Turkey post-failed coup, and we're going to take a very short break, and we've got a couple of other guests who will be joining us through the hour. You can join us as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyyradio. Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about Turkey after the failed coup of just a couple of weeks ago. And joining us now is Stephen Cook. He's the Eni Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He writes the blog From the Potomac to the Euphrates, joining us from the Council on Foreign Relations. And Stephen Cook, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We just said goodbye to Tim Arango, who's in Istanbul, talking about if life is getting back to normal, if there is a normal after a coup. What are you seeing or what are you hearing from Turkey?
Well, I think on the surface, things seem to be getting back to normal. But in conversations with friends, whether text message, email or phone, people are quite apprehensive about the purge that's underway, the chaotic situation, the realization that Turkey is now a country that is manifestly unstable. We're not only just talking about the aftermath of a coup. As you and Tim were talking about just a few moments ago, there is a war going on in the southeastern part of the country between the Turkish state and the PKK, these Kurdish militants who've been waging war, a terrorist war against the Turkish state since 1984. Turkey's been the victim of 11 terrorist attacks over the course of the last 12 months, six of which can be tied to the Islamic State. And now we have the political turmoil in the aftermath of the coup. So I think Turks are bewildered. They're angry. They feel isolated. They feel as if the United States and the European Union have not supported them at this moment when they feel that they need the diplomatic and political support of their primary allies.
Are we witnessing a democracy that could turn into some kind of autocracy?
Well, I think we've already passed that point. Well before this incident, this failed coup, then Prime Minister Erdogan, now President Erdogan, has taken a number of steps to reverse what seemed to be a promising liberalization in 2003 and 2004, just after his party, the Justice and Development Party, came to power. But over the course of the last 7 or 8 years, there's been a reversal of these reforms. He has gone after his opponents. On a per capita basis, Turkey jails more journalists than any other country in the world. Academics have been on the run. It's a fairly grim situation politically for Turkey, although President Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party keep winning elections. And I think that speaks to the polarization of the country. Half the country supports President Erdogan and his party. And the rest of the country does not. And for the rest of the country that are opponents of Erdogan, they are intimidated by him and the Justice Development Party and the Turkish state.
Back in 2004, Turkey was invited to join the EU, but it had to meet certain requirements. Is that invitation going to be rescinded?
Well, it is not going to be rescinded. The EU negotiation process for membership began in 2005. It has essentially been in the deep freeze since it began due to European objections to Turkey's entry just on principle. I think there are European countries that object to the idea that a large Muslim country, Turkey's Muslim population is 99.8% Muslim, would be joining their very exclusive club. But now, after the course of the last 7 or 8 years, there are significant objections on political grounds to keep Turkey out of the European Union. A little more than 10 years after that invitation was issued, Turkey looks less like a liberal European democracy and more like a one-man elected autocracy.
It is home, as Tim Arango was telling us, to several million refugees. And obviously, that many refugees are going to make life really difficult for people living in Turkey and the government as well. How does that factor in?
Well, it's an important issue. At last count, the UNHCR said there were 2.7 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. Those are the ones who are registered with the
right.
UNHCR. There's likely many more than that. And the Turks have been quite good in seeking to care for these people. They've spent a lot of their own money, especially in comparison to previous refugee crises that the Turks have had to deal with, specifically from Iraq in the early 1990s. A large flood of Kurdish population came into the country. It has become a difficult issue in two ways. One, although President Erdogan enjoys tremendous political support, there has been a lot more circumspection about Turkey's Syria policy in general. The idea of getting more deeply involved in Syria is something that Turks, I think, across the political spectrum are wary of. And then the other issue is what to do with these
right.
2.7 or 3 million or more people. We're getting to the point in the Syria conflict where refugees aren't going to go home. And Erdogan had floated the idea that some subset of these Syrian refugees would be granted Turkish citizenship, and that was met with an uproar. So it is yet another very challenging political issue before the Turkish government and the Turkish people.
Well, if they can't get into the rest of Europe or they can't go back home, these are the refugees, of course, they are in limbo. That just is not tenable. It seems certainly long term.
Well, it doesn't seem
maybe
tenable.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
Of course, you know, we have Palestinian refugees, Iraqi refugees who've been living for long periods of time in neighboring countries. But it is something that Turks are growing wary of and weary of, that they will have this permanent population of Syrians within their borders, and that it does put a strain on their own resources. And the question is how how to integrate them, if at all. I must say that as difficult as the situation is, if not for the Justice and Development Party and its kind of broader view of Muslim solidarity, the Turks may not have been as good as they have been on the refugee issue. That's not, of course, excusing the kind of authoritarian turn that we've seen in Turkey. But nevertheless, they have been better on the refugee issue than some of Syria's other neighbors.
I do want to talk about this cleric who is in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. We have a third guest waiting in the wings. But a question to you, Stephen Cook. What then do you see as the role, the responsibility of the United States?
Well, the United States is obviously in an extraordinarily difficult position. One could argue that the Obama administration stumbled on the night of July 15th by when Secretary Kerry made a kind of equivocal statement about the coup, and only after it was clear it was failing did President Obama make a statement about the need to uphold democracy and the importance of elections and elected leaders. I think the default position should be, as problematic as Erdogan has been, is that the United States supports the elected leaders.
And he was elected.
At the same time.
And he was elected.
He was absolutely – his presidential election, he won 52% of the vote in August 2014. I think the problem that the United States is currently having is that the Turks are trying to politicize the extradition process of this cleric Fethullah Gulen. And they're also directly blaming the United States for taking part in the coup. So it makes it more difficult for the Turks to have a fair hearing in Washington when the – pro-government press, political leaders in Turkey are accusing the United States of trying to murder the president of a NATO ally.
Do you think the U.S. was involved in the coup in any way, part of the coup attempt?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it was, if anything, the United States was unable to detect the factions of Gulenists who had infiltrated the military. But that is an era of omission, not an era of commission.
And that's Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can check out his blog as at From the Potomac to the Euphrates. And we have been talking about this Fethullah Gulen. He is named by the president of Turkey, blaming this cleric for orchestrating this failed coup of just a couple of weeks ago. And as it turns out, Fethullah Gulen lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. Joshua Hendrick joins us now. He's an assistant professor of sociology and global studies at Loyola University, author of a book called Gulen, The Ambiguous Politics of Market Islam in Turkey and the World. And Joshua Hendrick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. We're talking about a cleric, Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania, which is in the Poconos. Have you been to Sailorsburg, Joshua?
I have not been to Sailorsburg. My work was specifically focused in Turkey. I spent a little shy of two years with a variety of people and institutions affiliated with the Gulen movement there, and then I've spent a number of time in a variety of other cities in the U.S. Looking into the Gulen movement's activities here.
Does anyone know how he ended up in the Poconos? Do you know that, Joshua?
Yeah, the venue he's at is actually registered nonprofit organization, the Golden Generation Worship and Retreat Center. He didn't go there immediately. He came to the U.S. in 1999, according to followers and loyalists, for health reasons. According to critics, he narrowly skirted an arrest warrant that was issued against him for being the leader of an alleged organization with intentions to overthrow the Turkish state. Now, those charges were dropped in 2006 after he had long been in the United States. But nonetheless, he came to the United States and after a brief stint in Virginia, eventually settled in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania.
Stephen, let me go back to you. There are Gulenists in Turkey. What does it mean to call yourself that?
Well, that's probably a question better directed to Josh, but I think someone who is an acolyte and a follower of this movement, this officially called the Hizmet movement, and who followed the teachings of Fethullah Gulen, a kind of outwardly liberal type of Islam that tries to incorporate important parts of science and so on and so forth and advance peace and brotherhood throughout Turkey and the world.
You want to add to that, Joshua?
I would say the answer to your question of what qualifies one as a Gulenist or not, there's actually various levels of affiliation. And so someone who Gulenist is not, you know, obviously not a name. That's somebody who participates in the organization with full level of dedication would call themselves. They would refer to themselves as being inspired by the teachings of Fethullah Gulen, or perhaps perhaps use he's met the Turkish word for service, which is how the Gulen community frames all of its actions as being in the service of some higher purpose, whether that is, as their stated objectives have long said, peace and conflict, peace and conflict resolution, social justice, dialogue between different groups, and a variety of other what in colloquial terms we would call liberal goals.
He's also opened a number of schools, including a number of schools in Pennsylvania. What do we know about that, Josh?
Well, the schools in Turkey and around the world, the U.S. excluded, are private schools, of which the community for since the early 90s has operated schools growing to well over 100 countries, as well as many other companies, both in and outside Turkey. In the United States, beginning in the early 2000s, affiliates of the Gulen community took advantage of the school choice movement here to apply for charter funding to manage publicly funded but privately managed educational institutions in a number of states, of which they're in 26 in Washington, D.C., by my last count, and give or take around 150 schools. Year over year, a handful of new schools may come online having received a charter, but another handful may be on probation for one another reason or perhaps have their charter not renewed. So it's give or take about 150 about now in 26 states in Washington, D.C.
Stephen, let me go back to you. And for a while, Erdogan and Gulen were allies, were on the same side. What caused the rift?
Well, there were a number of issues, but going back to what you and Timuranga were talking about a bit earlier, the Gulenists are not as progressive or forward-leaning, for lack of a better term, on the resolution of the conflict between Turkey and the PKK. For all of their emphasis on conflict resolution, this is something that went too far for them, and they sought to go after, through their agents within the judiciary and the prosecutor's office, then Prime Minister Erdogan's one of his primary advisors, the head of the Turkish National Intelligence Organization, a gentleman named Hakan Fidan. That was in 2012 and 2013. Erdogan responded to that effort on the part of Gulenists by closing down private schools, including Gulenist charter schools in Turkey, which hit the Gulenists where it hurt the most, in their wallet. And we were often running in a kind of tit-for-tat, one thing after the other, until late 2013, early 2014, and Gulenists within the police forces released tapes of alleging spectacular corruption at the highest levels of the Turkish government. And since then, there has been essentially open warfare between Prime Minister Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party, which comes from a different Islamist strain in Turkey than the Gulenists and Gulen's followers. And the government and the AKP has had the upper hand and has gone about, like I said, closing schools, shutting down Gulenist-affiliated media outlets, arresting Gulenist-affiliated journalists and others. There is something, you know, for all of this discussion about the Gulen movement and the kind of good works, they have nestled themselves within the state bureaucracy. They have sought to use the resources of the state in order to change the character of the state. And there's an issue with their transparency that makes it one question what their ultimate goals are. And I think that that's one of the problems that we here in the West have a hard time really understanding, given the kind of outward rhetorical emphasis on, you know, peace and good works in the world versus what the Turks are saying, that this is a man who is essentially like Osama bin Laden, which is very, very difficult.
I mean, you're
exactly,
saying
a terrorist. So it's a very difficult situation that for U.S. policymakers as well to try to deal with an ally that is outraged by this man who is living in Sailorsburg, Pennsylvania, and the need for serious evidence of what he has done and the fact that, you know, and to support the allegations that he is in fact a terrorist.
Well, Josh, we're almost up on a break here, but I've also read descriptions of Gulen and his organization as a kind of a cult, and him as a kind of a cult leader. Does that fit with your picture of him?
Well, again, the levels of affiliation exist in various spheres of orbits around a core of a community. So if there is a core of loyalists who dedicate much of their individual behaviors towards the good of the group, which would be the more less loaded way to articulate a cult. I know of a number of people who have come and gone from the movement and from that core center area whereby there is a more total devotion. Now, if you do in fact leave, there is a full awareness that you do not reap any reward and will receive no favor that you received when you were fully participating. But I think far more to the point of the ambiguity about this organization is the authority structure and the organizational structures.
You know what, Joshua? Hold on, only because hold on. We just have to take a very short break. So hold on to that.
Sure.
We'll take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about Turkey post-coup. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking about the failed coup mid-July in Turkey. The Turkish authorities say the coup was orchestrated by the U.S. government and also by someone named Fethullah Gulen, who's a Turkish cleric living in the Poconos in Pennsylvania in Sailorsburg. Talking with Joshua Hendrick, an assistant professor of sociology and global studies at Loyola University in Maryland, wrote a book called Gulen. Also with us, Stephen Cook, and he's senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Josh, I had to jump on your words because we were coming up on that break. You want to just finish your sentence?
Sure, no problem at all. The question was in regard to, you know, is the Gulen movement a cult and is Fethullah Gulen a cult leader? And I would say that in my experience, it's not quite that easy and that too many people come and go within the movement. I will say that participating within the community does come with material reward as well as personal reward, and what I see no reason to believe, not to believe, a spiritual reward. That said, when people do leave the community, it is under the auspices that no more rewards or favors will happen thereafter, despite your services to the community and its efforts as you were participating.
Let me quote something that Fethullah Gulen wrote in the New York Times, an op-ed on July 25th. He says, Turkey's president is blackmailing the United States by threatening to curb his country's support for the international coalition against ISIS. His goal to ensure my extradition despite a lack of credible evidence and virtually no prospect for a fair trial. The temptation to give Mr. Erdogan whatever he wants is understandable, but the United States must resist it. Stephen, let me go to you. Has Turkey formally asked for extradition of this cleric?
No, they haven't. There is a Turkish parliamentary delegation in Washington this week, and they are here to kind of soften up the Washington community and give them their version of events. And then in a couple weeks' time, we'll see the Turkish foreign minister and justice minister who will come with allegedly the evidence that they have against Fethullah Gulen. But up until this point, there has not been a formal extradition request. There has been previously in late 2015, the Turks had requested the extradition of Gulen, but no formal process has begun. The United States has said to this point they will work with the Turkish government on this request and let the judicial process wend its way through the courts until there is a decision. I think the concern is that the Turkish government is insisting on this extradition, and that, as Tim Arango pointed out earlier in the conversation, that Turks are bewildered by the fact that the United States doesn't hand this guy over to them, and that the Turkish government will in turn now politicize the process. And one of the things that people here in Washington are worried about is the way in which the United States uses Incirlik Air Base in Turkey's southeast, which is very close to area of operations against the Islamic State. And would Turkey curtail operations there to put pressure on Washington to hand over Fethullah Gulen?
This is a related question. We've got David from Flemington joining us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. My question is, would not acquiescing to Turkey regarding Gulen be expected to be enough to result in Turkey embracing policies and taking actions that would significantly affect our international security? Thank you.
All right, David. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Josh, this is looking ahead, but if there is some kind of formal request for extradition, how do you see that playing out?
Well, once that process happens, which I see no reason why it wouldn't, it would the U.S. is bound by international law of extraditions, and as Stephen said, it would work its way through an arbitration process. In that context, Fethullah Gulen has full rights of movement and travel, as well as permanent residency. His immigration case, getting all this legal paperwork, began shortly after his arrival in the United States and then concluded in 2008 when he finally received his green card. But with free movement, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't see what might stop him from legally leaving the country to another third country that does not have an extradition agreement with Turkey. And in the chatter that I observe, Australia, South Africa are both mentioned as countries that are on the table as such. There's allegations, conspiratorial allegations in Turkish newspapers that Egypt has been approached, although Egypt denies that.
He is 77 years old. Has he ever or does he want to be president of Turkey, Josh? And then we're going to have to say goodbye to you and we'll continue on with Stephen Cook.
Sure, no problem. The long-stated aims of the Gulen movement have always been not to directly participate in politics, but instead in other sectors of social power in the marketplace, and that is mentioned, Stephen, in institutions of state, sort of more appointed bureaucratic institutions of state. Fethullah Gulen has never, in fact, spent a career espousing quite the opposite of having no aspirations to be the head of state, which is the best defense the Gulen movement has right now to offer both Turks and the world is their stated aims over the past 30, 40 years to be a more civil society actor than a political actor. How much these events fly in the face of everything they've said they were about themselves and who he is and his aims were. Is really the best defense they have. How much then evidence can corroborate or not corroborate these stated aims is really what we are all observing.
Yeah, and certainly time will tell. Josh Hendrick, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Pleasure for us. From Loyola University in Maryland, wrote a book called Gulen. And Stephen Cook staying with us for the rest of the hour from the Council on Foreign Relations. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I want to read a bunch of comments here as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stephen, a tweet from Dodo says, I'm not really sure who was behind this, but I am 100% sure that Mr. Erdogan will be more powerful after this attempted coup. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly in the short run, and there's very little reason to believe that over the medium and longer term that Erdogan, who now has the kind of political support necessary to really, as he has said before, root out the Gulen movement, that he won't be more powerful than ever before. Erdogan has sought the transformation of Turkish society and the Turkish political system. And over the course of the last number of years, it has been an effort to alter Turkey's political system to make it a purely presidential system. At the moment, it's a hybrid presidential parliamentary system where the focal point is actually the prime minister, although Erdogan clearly remains the main actor. And he wants a presidential system where all the power flows to the presidency, all the formal powers flow to the presidency and an office that he currently occupies. I see at this point no reason why he can't make that happen given current circumstances.
Let me read a couple of other comments. This is something we talked on earlier, an email from Sam says, before the coup attempt, there had been rumors that the Turkish government was planning to gift the Syrian refugees with citizenship. I would like to hear your guest's opinion of the situation in the aftermath of the coup. And you did mention that. Has that been withdrawn, or the future will tell what happens with this offer of citizenship?
It's unclear what will happen at this moment as the Turkish government and Turkish society is focused on the purge of alleged Gulenists and coup supporters from the bureaucracy and the education system and the judiciary and the military. When things calm down in the coming weeks and months, and the Turks return to the concerns that they had prior to July 15th, we'll have to see what happens with the disposition of that subset of Syrian citizens that were said to have been – the idea was floated that they would get Turkish citizenship. At this point, though, all of the focus has really been on the aftermath of the coup and reshaping the Turkish bureaucracy and the Turkish military to prevent this kind of thing from happening ever again.
Let me see what Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware, what Dorsey has to say. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Yes, hello. I have a dear friend who is an American citizen, but who has moved back to Turkey because she grew up there. And I visited her a number of times in Turkey from the last 20 years. And she is absolutely terrified of what's going on. She's afraid to say anything in public. Or she said he was a good mayor of Istanbul, but he has become more and more a dictator. He's really frightening, and the extreme religious requirements are going on. She also said after the coup that apparently, according to her, there was a soldier who had his throat cut on a bridge. I mean, she just says it's appalling. Also, Erdogan has built what's described, I've seen described variously as a 1,000-room or 1,500-room called the White Palace. He's just turned into a megalomaniac, and it's very sad. Frankly, I'm sorry that the coup didn't work.
Well, that's interesting.
Because historically, the army has been a defender of secular democracy.
Well, Dorsey, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Stephen Cook, I think she's not alone in that. I think some people were hoping that the coup would work. Obviously, it's complicated because you're talking about someone who was elected president of a country.
I, without a doubt, there were people who were supportive of this effort to bring Erdogan down. But coups are, by them, in and of themselves, not democratic. And I think the idea that the Turkish military upheld secular democracy is a misunderstanding of Turkish history. Turkey has never really been a democracy. It certainly has had free and fair elections and multi-party elections since 1946. But the fact that the Turkish military has always reserved for itself the right to intervene in the political system and has undertaken four coups between 1960 and 1997 and intervened in the political system any number of times in between and after those events would suggest that Turkey's hardly a consolidated democracy. In addition, when you look at the Turkish constitution as it was written at the behest of the junta that came to power in 1980, it was a document that was intended on protecting the Turkish state from the individual rather than a constitution that really laid out and protected the individual and political rights of Turkish citizens.
Would there be any way to run this experiment? I mean, if that coup had been successful, what would Turkey be today? Or are there just too many moving unknown parts?
I think that there's too many moving and unknown parts. I mean, we can replay this any number of ways.
Sure.
But if Turkey is unstable now, imagine a situation in which a coup is successful, though it has millions and millions of opponents. The kind of coercion and force necessary to keep people down would be significant. As much as this widespread crackdown and purge is quite bad in Turkey already, one can imagine that it'd be equally problematic from the other end if the coup had been successful.
Let me read an email from Beverly. Even before the coup, Erdogan was curtailing the rights of women, journalists, academics, and anyone opposed to his increasingly dictatorial reign, and was turning the country from a secular one into a conservative Islamic state with limited rights for moderates and progressives. The coup has given him permission to go after these moderates with a vengeance. Is that how you see it?
Well,
or is that your concern?
Well, certainly Erdogan has been going after his opponents. I think that the problem in Turkey is has less to do with religion and less having to do with Islamism, though, of course, Erdogan comes from an Islamist tradition. The problem really in Turkey is one of authoritarianism, and Erdogan believing that he has a vision for society and that only he and a small cadre and the AKP, his party, the Justice and Development Party, being a mechanism for realizing that vision, and part of that vision is his unbounded ambition. There's never in the cards that Turkey would become an Islamic state. One of the, I think, great electoral advantages that the Justice and Development Party has had is that it has permitted, since it came to power in late 2002, early 2003, has allowed Turks to explore their identities, their Muslim, their religious identities in ways that they were never able to before because of the enforced secularism of the Turkish state. Erdogan, for all of his problems, has continually said that there can be piety and pious politics within a officially secular state. And what they've done is they've kind of normalized the idea of being a pious Muslim in Turkish society, something that was 15 years ago seen as reactionary among the then prevailing Turkish elite.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye. So you talked about his, meaning Erdogan's, unbounded ambition. Ambition, I mean, he is the president of the country. What more does he want?
Well, he doesn't believe that the transformation of Turkish society is complete, and he believes that he is the one to do it. And this purge that's going on that will vacuum up Gulenists and members of the old elite who he calls the White Turks will advance that process so that the elite who have enjoyed political and economic power under Erdogan, who have explored their religious identities in new and different ways, they become the elite. They are the future of Turkey.
Well, on that note, Stephen Cook, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can check out his blog, From the Potomac to the Euphrates. Also spoke with Josh Hendrick, who wrote a book called Gulen, and we began with Tim Arango, Baghdad and Istanbul bureau chief for The New York Times, catching us up on what's been happening in Turkey over the last couple of weeks. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter as well. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.